Proposed responses to climate change range from the simple and easy to the complex and far-reaching. As these efforts get underway, it's important to go in with our eyes open to avoid doing harm in our quest to do good. You're listening to Friday Podcasts from the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Wilson Center. In this special series, produced with USAID's Office of Conflict Management and Mitigation, we interview experts about backdraft, the unintended peace and conflict consequences of climate change responses. I'm Sean Peoples, and today I'm speaking with Jesse Ribeau, professor at the University of Illinois, on why it's so important for climate interventions to work through local democracy. Jesse, thank you for joining me today. I wanted to discuss your perspective on climate change risk and some of the misperceptions around addressing root causes, especially for vulnerable populations.
When I come to a question like, what is the cause of a climate-related disaster? And I begin to realize that we admit certain causes because they're actionable and we eliminate other causes because we can't do anything about them. And suddenly, there are a whole realm of causes in the middle that we eliminate because some people think we can't do anything about them because they're political, because that cause leads to responsibility, liability, blame. And suddenly, you're dealing with a whole different idea of what is causality, and a political philosopher can help you think about how we've traditionally put together cause and blame, cause and responsibility in ways that I would struggle to systematize.
So for your own work, how is that changing your idea of what you're doing and how, what you've been doing?
It's something I have had in my mind for a long time, but it seems to me that we really do need to understand that as scientists, for example, modeling the effects that follow a climate event. And I say effects that follow because they're not caused by it. They're caused by a set of conditions that they meet on the ground called vulnerability. If people aren't vulnerable, a hazard is reduced to, it's demoted, right, to a nuisance. But the minute people are vulnerable, a climate event becomes a hazard. And then we're thinking, well, okay, how do we think about causality under these conditions? If we're modeling and thinking that the event happens and hits these people and they're damaged, the drought hits the crop, causes the crop failure, causes hunger, causes famine, dislocation, economic loss. If we think of that as our causal model, that sounds very scientific. But in fact, the very reason we're even modeling it and asking the question is because the things that are being damaged are losses of valued attributes. So even in the framing, value comes into the questions we ask as scientists.
I wanted to take a step back for a minute and just hear about what are you working on in terms of climate mitigation or adaptation? What is your research?
There are two strands of my work over the past 30 years that are coming together now. But let me start with one, which does have to do with issues of some of the effects of climate adaptation and mitigation policies. And that's a project that I recently finished on the local democracy effects of the implementation of REDD+ and adaptation projects in sub-Saharan Africa. Now, before I get into that, the other work that I've done over many years has had to do with how we explain climate change. How do we explain the causes? And this is why my more recent reflections on this are coming back to that older work. But the work on local democracy that I'm now finishing looked at the implementation of REDD+ and adaptation projects in 13 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. I believe we had 24 case studies that were completed. There were more than that that began. A couple did not get completed. But we tried to look at, when implementing these projects, which are mandated to consult with and engage local populations, some of them through free, prior, and informed consent. Some of them claim to be working through democratic processes. What we found was that the engagement in the communities was grossly inadequate, almost systematically, and not in ways that were subtle, but, for example, in communities, forest-dependent communities that have elected local governments, which almost all the ones we looked at did, the RED and RED readiness and other forestry projects, because RED was not present in many of the places we studied, hadn't yet been implemented. We got there too early. They would circumvent local government. They'd circumvent local government because, well, you know, those people, it's kind of cumbersome to work with them. It takes a long time. It's inconvenient. Or, well, they're not the affected population that, you know, works in the forest. But in fact, the forest belongs to the whole community. So it's not just the people who use the forest who should decide over it. It is the community, and it should be represented democratically. Or you get the model where the donors come in. World Bank does this often. USAID does this. And they say, let's work with local customary chiefs because they represent the people. Well, they don't represent the people. They speak for the people, whether the people like it or not. And in fact, often the people will say, yes, they are the people who speak for us. But when you ask them later, are they, you ask them even, are they legitimate? Yes, they have the right to speak for us. Do you think what they're saying is right? Well, of course, they are the ones who speak for us, so what they say is right. Do you like what they say? No, of course not. They're ripping us off. They make us, you know, do these works that we don't want to do. No. So, in fact, even if a local customary authority is legitimate, they don't necessarily, and in many cases don't, represent people. There are some that do. There are some, and I define representation here as being responsive, well, democratic representation, responsive to and accountable to the people. There are many leaders who are responsive because they believe it's their role. That we call that benign dictatorship. Great. Nice if your dictator happens to be benign. But the reason we want to privilege democracy is because if your dictator happens not to be benign, you can actually vote them out and you can get someone new, and maybe they're not going to be great, but you still have some option, some way of sanctioning your leaders. It's harder in traditional systems to do that.
In a traditional system where you are butting up against some of those customs, how do you make that process more democratic? How do you get greater participation?
Well, first off, we worked in areas where there were elected local governments, even when there were customary chiefs as well. So one of the issues you run into is what's called legal pluralism, where you have an Islamic leader, you have a customary chief who's not, you know, more pre-Islamic period, you also have a democratic elected local government, and you also have administrators of the central government, all claiming to be able to make decisions on the same issues. Gets quite complicated and confusing. But what you have here is a situation where an intervening program chooses who they're going to work with in the local arena. If they choose to work with democratic local government, then a process comes into gear in which that democratic local government begins to make decisions, and perhaps they'll have conflicts with the local chiefs. But it starts with them having the upper hand in decision making. If they go in and say, oh, you know, take us to your leader, right, and empower the customary chief, then you have a situation where you're reinforcing a non-democratic authority and delegitimating the existing elected local government. So one of the things we find is that legitimacy follows power. And if you're a project and you recognize a local actor as your interlocutor, as your local representative, you're empowering them. And that legitimates them. So why not empower the democratic elected local authority and work with them? That's, I think, the kind of process that we were trying to study. And we found that the donor agencies had many reasons and their frontline workers to circumvent the local elected authorities. And this was really disappointing. Even at the national scale, with Red Plus, in Ghana, Nigeria, and Uganda, we found that in these processes of free prior informed consent national consultations, most of the people who came to the consultations were NGOs from the capital city, consultants. Rarely did local people end up in the process, and they were usually invited local interested individuals who either were part of an NGO or something in the local arena, or perhaps even owned a forest. They didn't invite the elected local leaders. This is simply bad process. And it's, in some ways, it can be considered ignorance, in the sense that when you interview local development workers, oftentimes they can't define democracy in an operational way well enough to actually implement it. But secondly, they have to deliver a product, numbers of hectares under forest management, or number of contracts in a Red Plus program, for example. They come back empty-handed, they're going to get in trouble in their hierarchy. So the aid agency will say, well, you didn't do a great job. So if they have to work with a slow process like democracy, they might be in trouble. But then again, sometimes it's ideological. They'll say, well, you know, I think that democracy is a plurality of local institutions working together. And the, you know, that's the end. They skip the local government. Or they say, well, the local government is corrupt. We're not going to work with them.
If this process is deficient, if it's not properly democratic or egalitarian, what's the consequence? What is both unintended and understudied? I mean, what are we looking at in terms of issues of justice, issues of conflict?
Well, I don't know that we really know in the long run. But I do think that in the long run, local democracy plays a number of roles that are important. One is, as de Tocqueville argued, it is the nursery of democracy writ large. People learn democratic process in local democracy, and they go other places within their country and up the hierarchy. That's one function of local democracy. Secondly, I do think that democracy as a decision-making process, that is when you have authorities who are accountable to the people, does produce greater equity and efficiency and outcomes. And that's theoretical. We see it in some places, but so little of it has been implemented in the places that I tend to work in, local sub-Saharan jurisdictions, sub-Saharan Africa, that it's hard to make the correlation and really test the outcome. But that's the hope. And third, in terms of security, the Nobel laureate Amartya Sen showed that we don't get famines in places where there is national-level democracy. We do in places where there isn't. I would like to look at and test the hypothesis, do we have greater food security in areas? Does vulnerability go down where functional local democratic authority is in place? And when I say functional, I mean not just a bunch of elected local people, but they have to have the power to be responsive to the population, and there have to be means by which citizens are able to influence them. That is, to sanction them, to say, yeah, that's great what you did, or no, we're not happy. Now, they can do that through elections, but elections are never sufficient means. You need other forms of sanction. You need people to be able to speak publicly for and against. You need the courts, because governments may think they know better than the people do, and they sometimes do. but there needs to be that, at least that dialogue that is forced by mechanisms of accountability. Now, it is important to understand that democracy is a system of the mistrust of authority. So people who sit around, oh, we need more trust. No, we do need more trust, but it can't be blind. It needs to be through sanction because we do not trust, from the history of our understanding of government in Europe, when the United States was formed, we do not trust that authorities who can't be sanctioned will behave in ways that are good for the people. So those are the elements, I think, that need to be in place, is accountable and empowered local authorities. And there, I think, there could be a positive effect for security, food security, even for young people getting jobs and placement who might otherwise migrate across the Sahel, across the Sahara, and try and go to Europe.
One potential audience for some of this discussion is practitioners. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think they're pretty critical in terms of both implementation, but also taking and evolving these projects in ways that are more responsive to the evolution of ideas. And so are there practical things for a practitioner to hear from your perspective?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I just finished a research program that I mentioned earlier. And from the case studies, we developed a handbook for the implementation of adaptation and other forestry programs like RAD that would be supportive of democratic local authority. How do you do that? It's a how-to. It requires some research. I know project implementing agencies don't like to have to do that kind of research. But unfortunately, I think we do need a deeper engagement of social science in the building of our projects and programs. We also have a policy brief that we wrote on the same topic. What are the principles of local democracy that a project implementing agent needs to take into account, needs to think about when they're working? How do they evaluate whether they're being supportive or not of local democracy? And I think this would be one effective way to improve the implementation of programs.
To pull it back to some of the things that you've seen, the lack of representation of democratic representation in projects or in efforts to address climate, but also not address it in a way that's actually looking at some of the people, the actual people, the humans mm-hmm. who will be on the front lines of this. It seems that that's codified within the approach.
We don't look at the root causes. I think democracy is only one of them. The lack of representation, the inability to shape the political economy that shapes people's well-being, their assets and their social protections. They have no leverage over this, and therefore they live at a below subsistence level. And when a climate event, a flood, a storm, a drought comes along, and they go hungry or they're dislocated and they migrate, everyone says, oh, a climate disaster. No, it was about how they ended up in such a precarious position. It has nothing to do with the climate event that triggered that event, that set of migrations or losses. It has everything to do with how they have been pushed to the margin and ended up in a precarious place.
It's a big job to reverse and or even address the dimensions of that.
It's a very big job, and it's a job for policy. It's not about development projects, and it is not, and I mean not, about adaptive capacity. People are not vulnerable because they don't have adaptive capacity. They don't have the ability to survive a difficult period because their assets have been taken away, and they have no social protections. And because of that moral question we brought up earlier, which is that the state has a responsibility, government has a responsibility to make sure that they are not continuously being exploited and their income ratcheted down to the subsistence level so that once that storm comes along, they're going to go under.
if someone's sitting at USAID and they need to maybe take some of what you're saying and begin to practically include it in an approach, do you think that's possible?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. But they have to talk with people who really know each situation.
You've been listening to Friday Podcasts from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.